The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org.
Is anybody in the room actually right now involved in your business's mission kind of practitioner level? Sure. We're going to reserve half of the seminar time hearing some of your stories and fleshing some of that out as it pertains to our topic. So I hope you aren't gun shy with that. Anybody here representing more of the resourcers perspective, the donor or the investor, folks that are interested in giving either through foundations, through their own personal wealth, just as a good investment, a couple people. How about MBA students, anybody? A couple? Okay. What school are you from? And any other graduate students in the room? What graduate schools? Okay, what field? And anybody here who are undergraduates?
Awesome.
Okay. Well, I think that there are probably three main reasons why this topic was asked to be presented, and I'm very privileged and humbled to be asked to present this. I certainly don't claim to be an expert on the topic, but hopefully there will be pieces to my background that will be helpful and insightful to those of you that are wrestling with the funding issues, either from the practitioner side or from the investor side. So I think the three drivers for this, the need for this seminar, probably one is the push for sustainability. A lot of people out there in the world, I'm guessing there are people in this room that are involved with ministries or NGOs and have started to push the envelope a bit, are starting to get involved in things that start to look more and more like commercial enterprises. And part of that push is because you realize that there is this great vision of an actual enterprise that can sustain itself, that doesn't require the constant inflow of donor dollars. And that's a very noble idea, and so we can talk about some of those issues. I think another driver for this is that, more generally, people want to see BAMs proliferated. They want to see more and more BAMs be created. I think that's one of the reasons why Urbana has decided to do this track. But they also want to raise the bar on what those businesses look like. Because speaking from a donor's perspective, some of the businesses out there that are being pitched are being pitched to people who probably aren't very called to business, aren't very experienced in business, and have a high likelihood of failure. So we'll talk about some of those issues related to funding. And then I think probably the prevailing need is you are representing a potential enterprise or an existing enterprise that's just in need of capital. You want to help thinking through what are some of the threshold questions to ask of yourself to know who to identify, who to seek for capital. So hopefully provide some useful information and discussion. And I really want to emphasize that I'd love to have some interactive discussion for you. A little bit about me, just in brief.
We are broadcasting in Thanksgiving.
So I can do this while people are at this point. As Pete mentioned, Urbana 92 was a very seminal project, not only the
get a wife out of it, but I also. It was very influential in terms of my worldview and shaping my vision for how God should use people with whatever skills, whatever background they have. But to say that I had a calling for business is probably not accurate, looking back in retrospect. I probably landed in business a bit by accident, and this might resonate with some of you. Before there was a business track at Urbana, before there were all these wonderful thinkers like Steve Rundle here in the room, who have written books about the issues relating to the theology of business, I struggled with whether business was sort of a lesser field. In fact, the only reason why I entered into business coming out of college was because I had been whopping student loans, and I tried to find something that could help pay off those student loans as quickly as possible. And one thing led to another, and I went and got my MBA, and one thing led to another, and I'm suddenly doing biotech M&A and international licensing and traveling to China and India and other parts of the world and wrestling with a lot of this stuff, but again, without a real clear sense of calling to business per se. And I really applaud the people, especially the undergraduates in the room, that are wrestling with that right now and thinking about what it means to be a missionary or somebody who has a heart for the world and wants to see the kingdom advance through business. I had some brief dabblings with BAM back in the dot-com bubble. I wanted to go back to Central Ridge. I had some short-term missions experience, and that was a place that I had identified that the Lord had placed on my heart. I linked up with an Uzbek guy who wanted to do a travel website, a Central Asian travel website. And back then, you know, every business plan had the hockey stick, and in terms of revenue growth and you know, the valuations were totally out of whack with business fundamentals. And so we sort of concocted this business plan. And I honestly didn't think that it had any shot at getting funding. And amazingly, there were people who were interested because we wanted to mix business objectives with business objectives. And what it spoke to me, because I really felt like it was a half-baked business plan. This is back in 1989. What it spoke to me was the dearth of good triple bottom line enterprises, as you may be hearing a lot about here in the conference. Triple bottom line meaning financial return, social return, some might even throw in environmental, and then of course kingdom or ministry return on your investment. And there was such a shortage, I think, of those that even our little travel website that had no shot of really being a sustainable revenue model was piquing interest. But I think all along in my career, I had a real understanding, or at least a desire to see business be more than just profit and return on investment from a financial perspective. And I had an opportunity to do a number of different ventures related to that. Mercantil Perform was a Chilean company that was formed to sort of be a B2B website, sort of like an Ariba for Pan Latin America, and it got some early venture funding from North America, Bank of Boston, and then during the dot-com bust or burst, we sort of lost a little bit of our grounding. But it was a fantastic experience for me to start to think about some of the fundamental questions relating to how do you do business in an emerging market, how do you raise capital for emerging market businesses, and that was a super helpful thing. Most recently, and probably one of the main reasons why a lot of people are in the room here, though, is I, 14 months ago, joined a family foundation called First Fruit, and so I've now taken on the role of professional philanthropy, which is a bit of a different role. But it has elements of both sides of what we're going to talk about here, the donor model and the investor model, because when you're dealing with a foundation like ours is, where all the money is from one source and it's there, so we have a gigantic corpus of money, there are two sides to managing a foundation. One is to grow that corpus so you can have as much to give away as possible for as long as possible, and also the giving away. And so there are going to be elements of looking at a lot of private equity and a lot of the ventures that potentially could be appealing to people who are looking at it from just an investment perspective. And then there are other things that are going to fall more in line with your traditional nonprofit ventures with perhaps some social enterprise aspects to it. So we'll talk to you about that. Let me start off with a little bit of introduction on how I see this presentation in context with the rest of what you guys are going to do for the next three or four days. There are going to be a lot of things in this conference that are going to be causing you to wrestle with this theology. How do you see God can use you? And what is the most meaningful way that you can spend your hours and energy for your life? And is business, and what type of business can that be potentially a venue for? And so I think that even when we talk about funding issues, it'll touch upon some of these theological questions, which some of which we're going to leave unanswered, because I think they're big issues or big questions for you to wrestle with. If you're a nonprofit who's launching into some business ventures, how are you going to deal with equity ownership? Is that even allowable under 501c3 IRS rulings? You know, there's lots of things along those lines, but I think there are also theological questions or at least sort of ethical kingdom questions that you might ask. My heart, and I think the heart of Urbana, is primarily in emphasizing the developing world and the lesson least reached. Maybe there's a stronger bias with me on that than the general open for business. So I just want to sort of state that up front, that when I talk about some of these issues, I really want to help people imagine what it would take to set up a business in a pretty tough place. Tough from the perspective of economic infrastructure, legal infrastructure, other things not being often very well in place, and also tough from the perspective of being an open Christian witness in a place where there aren't a lot of Christians. And that's really where I see the greatest opportunity for BAM, and so I'd like to really put a little bit of extra emphasis on that. And then the last thing I want to just mention as an introduction is that I'm not a nonprofit lawyer. I may have a Wharton MBA, but I'm not a finance whiz. So I don't want to make this into, I don't want to bog this down into a technical presentation on some of these finer points. I think I'll sort of try to tee up some of the issues, and we can talk about them, we can ask questions, but I'm probably not going to be able to get into a lot of very, very granular specifics on some of the things that you might have questions on. And so I would just encourage you, if you do have, if you represent, let's say, a missions agency, you talk to your nonprofit board about some of the finer points. Okay. This is, just to kind of kick off the whole point of this seminar, which is, you know, you've got the investor perspective, you've got the donor perspective, and for most people, they see it as a bright line. It's either or, and perhaps there's already a well-adopted practice that blurs those lines a little bit, and here is an example of that. Point here, I didn't realize the video was so long, is this is a very familiar toy to a lot of people. Can you name who it is?
Elmo.
And who created Elmo? That's right, Sesame Street did. And Sesame Street, is that a for-profit venture? No, it's a non-profit. It's actually a non-profit that has, according to its 990, which is an IRS filing, $435 million in assets, $107 million last year in income. And of that $107 million, $48 million in product licensing. So Elmo gets sold by Fisher-Price, but the reason why Fisher-Price can sell Elmo toys and Elmo stickers and Elmo, you know, everything else, is because they license the rights from Sesame Workshop. And so here's a nonprofit that obviously has an incredibly profitable, incredibly successful business venture. And there are lots of other examples of this. Oxford University in the UK has a publishing arm that does books. A lot of you guys have probably read a book that was published by Oxford University Press. $78 million in sales last year. Who's that? One of our speakers here, Rick Warren. Well, Rick Warren's Purpose-Driven Ministries is, according to its IRS filing, which you know is public domain, so not this is no secret, made $7.5 million in special events, basically their conferences, which is their main moneymaker, and $19 million last year in net gain. So in other words, net income for the year was $19 million for purpose-driven ministry. So they found a model. I mean, they're a registered 501c3, but they found a model that, at least for the time being, is showing some pretty healthy profit. Now, they obviously need to continue to use that profit for its non-profit intentions or its tax-exempt charter, and we'll talk about some of that. The last is the International Finance Corporation, and this is an entity that I think should be familiar to you if you're going to do any kind of work in the developing world, particularly in emerging markets or transitional economies. It's the World Bank's private sector investing arm. Some of you guys are going to be involved in ventures that will be eligible for IFC funding. And in fact, the IFC would love, I bet, and I happen to have met a couple of the executives and did a 6-month stint there, they would love to see some innovative businesses that have sound business plans that are in some tough places. Because frankly, not a lot of people would be motivated to set up shop in Zambia or Laos or some of these other places, and the IFC is one of the trailblazers in allowing for capital markets to be developed for ventures in those types of places. With acknowledgement to Professor Gregory Dees at, I think, Harvard Business School, he developed this idea of a social enterprise spectrum, and I think the buzzword recently with social enterprise is that even the secular world recognizes that, that a lot of these ventures that we're trying to do that has mission behind it is more than just a purely commercial enterprise. But it's also not just a purely philanthropic enterprise. And so it becomes a bit of a hybrid. And so when you evaluate that spectrum, you need to really look at a whole host of stakeholders. And I know this is a very busy slide. And by the way, at the end, I'll share my email address and you can ask for a copy of this presentation. But beneficiaries, meaning in the commercial sense, customers, who your funding sources are, suppliers, in all of these stakeholders, there are different degrees to which you're asking for, in essence, donations. And that's the further you go left, the more it becomes more philanthropic. It becomes you're dependent on in-kind donations, it's dependent on volunteer hours. I'm going to give you a case study of a company or an enterprise in Cambodia that most of its staff are missionaries. Well, their missionary salaries are off the books. So it becomes this sort of hybrid entity that you sort of have to wrestle with. How do we categorize that? And then depending on how we categorize that, depending on how we think about it, who can we ask for money? So I think the main purpose for today's seminar really is help the people in this room to ask or frame some threshold questions for yourself in establishing a BAM or funding a BAM. And I really see fundamentally this presentation being about the relationship between practitioner and resourcer. And I think that there is a very mutually beneficial relationship that we ought to see in that, especially when both parties are believers and have a mutual desire to see the kingdom advance. And so I want to walk through some questions that I think, as I look at a lot of business plans and also obviously nonprofit projects, what are the things that I would want you to ask of yourself? The first is, why me? And without discrediting missionaries that I've encountered on the field who I deeply admire, and I want to just say that to preface what I'm about to use it as an example, I deeply admire the commitment missionaries have to staying on the field and wanting to do God's work in really tough places. But when I get business plans from people who are classic missionaries, who tell me, for example, that in a particular very closed country with very little infrastructure that they're going to set up a pharmaceutical company. I came from a $100 billion biopharmaceutical company, so I know I have an appreciation for the complexity of that. I worry about whether they know, they even have 1% of a notion of what they're trying to get themselves into, let alone all of the sort of international laws and in-country laws that they're going to have to deal with. And so, you know, you ask what their background is, and they went to Bible college, maybe went to seminary, their professional experience has been in church planting. These are not people that should be doing a highly complex endeavor. Now, that's not to say that if you are from a traditional Christian studies or missions background, you can't launch a business. I'm not saying that at all, but what I would say is I would encourage you to think about your team. Recruit people on your team that might have some experience in business, and also try to gain some experience. Do it in smaller steps. Set up a consulting company that basically requires no more investment than it would for you to do a ministry in that setting. Or set up a small operation of some sort that that is more appropriate to both the local context and perhaps your background. The other question that I think you ought to really wrestle with is why that particular venture? And there are lots of dimensions to this. I mean, the size is one. A lot of people come with some pretty grandiose ideas. Now, some of you guys in this room are going to be really gifted at business, and you're going to be able to pull off a grandiose vision. And so I'm not discouraging from that. If you read some of the books in the bibliography, you read about people who have started multi-billion-dollar publicly traded companies in places like China, and who are Christians, who have every damn objective that we all want to have. And so some of you can pull it off, but most shouldn't try that. Most should try to really think about an appropriately sized venture, particularly for that context, and also it will help you with your donor or investor objectives, because I think when you're talking to me about a $50,000 investment as opposed to a $500 or a $5 million investment, it's a lot more palatable in the lower end if I know that it's a highly risky venture. And it's always going to be a highly risky venture in some of these places. Where is it is clearly an important question. There are some things that you think would be, oh my gosh, it would be so easy to set up a call center in whatever country, North Korea. Well, North Korea doesn't happen to have diplomatic relations that are very nice with the U.S., and so if you wanted to try to establish, you know, contracts and agreements across borders, it just would be complicated. It'd be very complicated. So try to know what these in-country laws, international laws are, so that you know that there's a feasibility to what you're doing. And if you're talking to a group of investors, that you're actually trying to make a pitch that they're going to get a return on their investment, well, do you even know that you can repatriate cash? If you generate cash flow in that country, are there even agreements in place between those two countries where you can bring cash back over to be able to pay back the investors? It's a pretty basic question that we take for granted here in the U.S., but not to be taken for granted in a lot of these places. This is a question that I really, really want to emphasize, which is, what are you trying to accomplish? The reality is that a lot of people talk BAM, but they're either one of two sides. They're usually gravitating toward one of two sides. They're really ministry, and they operate like a nonprofit, and they haven't really fleshed out all of the details of what would constitute a really strong business plan. And so they will probably rely on some level of donor contribution in perpetuity or seeming perpetuity. Or the other side, which is they really are a good business, or they're thinking very commercially, but some of the spiritual metrics are going to be somewhat marginalized in the way that they envision, the way that they actually measure the impact. And so I really ask you, as you think about the ventures that you're a part of, to wrestle with this question in as much heartfelt detail as you can, because this is an important question for somebody like me who have to evaluate whether I'm going to bring this to my board or bring it to my principal as a potential investment opportunity.
Who are my key stakeholders? The ideal vision of BAM is one where you have a venture that blesses the government, that blesses the community, that blesses this customer, that blesses the shareholder, that blesses the employee, that blesses blah, 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 right? Everybody. You want to bless everybody. But, the truth is that some businesses, you're not going to have a huge impact on government relations. You're not going to have a huge impact even on more than a small number of people who you're trying to employ, so there's not a huge community-wide impact. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but we have to think about who our stakeholders are, what is our degree of accountability to those stakeholders, and then as it pertains to the donor-investor spectrum, do they have any claims on my profits? I asked this question separately, even though it seems like it's been addressed before, because what I want to ask people to think about is what do you really expect, right? Because what ends up happening a lot of times is that when push comes to shove, you want a grant, so you're trying to make this sound like a legitimate business, and so there's sort of mixed messages, and so I want you to think about this question. What am I really expecting? Because based on what you really expect, I think you can more honestly do the last thing, which is, can I explain the elevator pitch, so to speak, in a pithy way, in a punchy way? I can't emphasize enough the importance of concise, effective communication of your venture. Whether you're talking to a sophisticated group of venture capitalists or a foundation, or whoever it is, most people struggle with being able to explain what they're trying to do in simple terms. So if you've wrestled with all these other things well enough, you'll be able to do the last thing, hopefully, quite well. Let's switch roles and think about it from the donor investor perspective. And this one was a little harder because I wasn't sure who was going to be in the room, so I tried to make it somewhat generic. I think the first question is, if you are somebody who comes from resources or represents some resources that you have the ability to contribute, you may not actually want to be doing all of your own due diligence and all of your own sourcing of investment opportunities. There are lots of people whose whole job it is to find these things and to find people like you to help them resource them. So consider seeking an intermediary of some sort. It could be a nonprofit. It could be a venture fund. It could be a lending program. And I really encourage you at Urbana. There are going to be lots of people. Dwight Nordstrom right in the back of the room is a great person to connect with as an example of people who are in the practice of this and can help navigate it a bit for you. But if you do some direct interfacing with a practitioner, here's some questions that I would ask. And some of the framing of these questions comes from having represented the principal, the chairman of the board of our foundation, who is a high net worth individual, who sees himself as, he's been a wildly successful businessman, and so there's lots of stuff that he's very engaged in on the foundation on the sort of grant making side, but people come to him all the time, as you can imagine, because of his high net worth, with business ideas. In fact, he's got four daughters, all four are married, and all four son-in-laws at different points have pitched an idea to him. And so I think about what he has to wrestle with, and one of the first questions is, what's compelling about the spiel that you just heard? It could be relationship. It could be where it's located. It could be the actual business concept of this plan. It could be that you want to learn through this investment or grant. It could be that you want to catalyze something. And so all of those factors, all the things that really kind of get you excited or tickle you about that venture can help shape, how much you might want to give, whether you want that gift to be a grant, whether you want it to be in some form of a loan, et cetera. The next question I'd ask is, what do you want to mostly accomplish by this venture? And
one of the things I've really learned in the 14 months I've been at the foundation is that with the right theology of giving, there should be joy. God intended it to be a joyful process. And so follow your joy if you're that donor or that investor. What is it about this that you really are excited about? And follow that. How do I feel about the risks? Now, I could do a simple checklist of due diligence questions. I chose not to because it's a little bit off of topic here. But clearly you got to do your homework. Figure out, what am I comfortable with? Have they done their due diligence? Who are the people that are involved? Management team? What's the structure of the financing that they're asking for? Is there an exit strategy if I do have equity invested in this venture, et cetera? And lastly, I would say, what form and amount of investment will be of greatest blessing? Now, part of what you may want to do with your contribution to that venture is to mobilize other investors. And so you want to apply that kind of thinking to the amounts of that investment and what type of investment you want to give. For example, if it's a pure grant, even if it's a BAM, you may decide that you want to make a pure grant. You may decide to make that a matching grant. And that's a pretty common vehicle that I think a lot of people in the room are familiar with. The IFC almost invariably does not go above 25%, in some cases 35%, of total post-money valuation equity of that company. And the reason for that is because they always want to take a minority position so they can bring other people in. Because their purpose is a World Bank purpose, a World Bank mission, which is to alleviate poverty, to improve the conditions of the people in that surrounding community. And one of the ways they know they have to be able to do that, and one of the rare rules they have, is to mobilize capital. So I think that's an important thing. And there's another thing to consider here is, what does what I give convey to other people about what I think about this venture? Now, if it's a $2 million business and I give $1,000, you basically took no risk, right? And it's throwaway money to you, clearly, but you also don't put a lot of weight and salt to the company. So you want to think about that in terms of if you're trying to really encourage others, do it in a way that if your name is attached to a certain amount of money, it's sort of this concept of the lead investor in the venture capital world, then what do you want to communicate by the structure, by the amount? And then finally, in a lot of BAMs, if you're appealing to people who have business experience and they have resources, they're going to ask you to be on their board. So you got to ask yourself, am I willing to do that? Am I willing to be like an incubator or like a venture capitalist in the sense of taking more of an activist position in the venture so that I can help steer, help mentor, help train, because those are clearly going to be great needs for a lot of bands that are going to be out there. Those of you who've read the book God Is at Work are going to be familiar with this. I think it's a helpful framework for thinking about different levels of investment. I won't go into this in great detail. But depending on the level of infrastructure, you're going to have basically three types of investments. Microenterprise, which is typically you're below 5,000. I think a lot of people are familiar with this. When I address this audience, I'm thinking of you guys as the administrator of the microenterprise program. So not the person who's making the individual $50 loan, but the person who might one day go to Indonesia and set up a microenterprise project that you want to make operationally self-sustainable or financially self-sustainable. Those are two different concepts. But what you essentially are trying to do is, in the most typical scenario, you want to raise donor support to get startup capital, to have your first loan pool, and then you distribute loans at an interest rate that allows you to basically function without additional donors. That's what you define as operationally sustainable. Financially sustainable would mean that you could actually pay back even the original donation, and it wouldn't be a donation, but it would be a loan.
And that's obviously a different level of profitability. Now, for some of you, and for a lot of Christian microenterprise, they tend to have a higher standard for the value add of their service beyond just the loan than the secular world does, but they also tend to perform a little less, more poorly in terms of the financial self-sustainability. So there's oftentimes a trade-off there, and you have to wrestle with that. A lot of you are going to be involved in SMEs, which are small, medium-sized enterprises, which is sort of the next level. And that's a level that's appropriate for certain economies, certain contexts, not always for all contexts. And then finally, for overseas private equity. Overseas private equity, I would say, is a realm that's going to impact a small minority of these, because these are typically larger ventures, more sophisticated ventures, and you have to have the conditions in that country to sustain private equity. China and India are the most prominent examples in emissions, or like sort of the more part of the world that we would consider the most likely emissions fields if you're thinking about both developing economic development and thinking about gospel reach, outreach. And those are two well-established private equity markets. But even there's obviously great risk. So let's do a couple case studies to try to illustrate this, and then we'll get into some discussion. Center for Community Transformation. This is a Filipino microenterprise development program. They are unabashedly Christian. If you go to see them on the ground, which I had a privilege to do, you'll see that at every one of their savings group meetings, they pray, they share the gospel, they do Bible study, they sing songs. It's thoroughly evangelical, thoroughly evangelistic. And yet they were able to be credible enough to become a Grameen Foundation partner, and they secured an $800,000 loan from the Filipino bank. So they're starting to sort of blur the lines, in a sense. Now, First Fruit made a contribution to them in the form of a pure donation, because we supported an aspect that wouldn't normally be able to be capitalized from their normal operation, which was a discipleship and training center that they wanted to use for as a sort of national headquarters. And it was a large investment that they, you know, weren't going to be able to sustain just through their loan proceeds. And so we treated that as a separate sort of non-profit project. But the $800,000 they got from the Bank of the Philippines was intended to be part of the expansion of their core program, which they intend to obviously pay back. So you see that there are elements of both investor and donor in an example like this. This is a project that hasn't launched yet, but has been brought to my attention just as another example of the type of thing that people are doing out there. The Advance is a business incubator, and they're operating right now in Laos, and they're trying to set up a goat meat and dairy farm in Laos. And the hope is that they will become self-sustainable in 3 years. I think that they project in their business plan something like $370,000 top line by year three. The Advance is going to be the owner of the company, or at least half owner of the company. They are also a registered 501c3 in the U.S. They're going to try to create up to 100 jobs, establish these vendor relationships, seek to get the approval and blessing of the Laotian government. They want to use the profits to expand into other provinces. They want to establish local fellowships everywhere they form their farm. And they want to transfer ownership over time to local leaders of the project via sweat equity, a method that's been made famous with Habitat for Humanity, for example. So this is an intriguing idea, and this may resonate with a lot of people in the room. You're a nonprofit. Trying to set up a small, medium-sized enterprise. But in this particular case, you're asking the startup capital to come from donors. And what's interesting about this story is they first tried to go to regular investors, and regular investors weren't getting it. So they switched financing strategies, and we'll see how they do. The last example is a fantastic story. I don't know if anybody has heard of Hagar, based in Cambodia, but Hagar was founded by a YWAM missionary. I don't know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, Swiss guy, went to Cambodia, saw the huge needs post Khmer Rouge, post Civil War. One of the huge needs was women and children who were trafficked. Decided to set up aftercare, rehabilitation. And, you know, there's this natural evolution that takes place. I mean, imagine that you're a woman or a girl that just got rescued by a group like IJM, International Justice Mission, which a lot of people are familiar with. And one of the greatest travesties about what I learned on the ground with IJM before Hagar's and others were really well established was that these girls would sometimes escape from their rescuers. And the reason for that is because they were put into such a dark, twisted world that they were told their only value in life was to send money back to their family, to their village, even though it was their own family oftentimes that sold them. And so these girls would escape. And so there was such a critical need for aftercare. Well, Hagar took a lot of these women and children in providing a tough, tough ministry. Now, well, what happens is you take these women that first need intense psychological counseling, need all sorts of rehabilitation, need to be put into a safe environment, need to form a sense of community, need to be taken, their children need to be taken care of, educated, blah, blah, blah. But eventually you want to reintegrate them into society. And what's the best way to do that is to give them meaningful work. Well, what Hagar started to do was first microenterprise. They said, okay, we're going to give you small little $50 loans, $100 loans. And so what a lot of these women would do is they would take them and they would buy soy milk or make soy milk and they would sell it at the local market. And it would, there's a limited shelf life when you're kind of doing it on an individual cart level. And so they were able to generally sustain themselves. But Hagar saw an opportunity and they said, let's scale this thing up. And so they built a plant and they built a company. And Hagar is the sole owner of the company. Well, and then they got IFC funding. And the IFC came alongside them and gave them a $450,000 convertible, participating, redeemable, preferred equity investment. Too complicated to explain, but it's basically a convertible loan that can convert into equity. And it's a sort of typical IFC mechanism. But this Hagar is a story that the IFC loves to talk about. They love to talk about it because this is right at the heart of their mission, even as a secular multilateral. And today, 83 people are employed, over $200,000 in sales. They've got two other businesses now that have launched. One is Hagar Catering, which does catering services for hotels and businesses in the international community, and iconically to the NGO community. And then Hagar Designs, which is a sort of handcrafts export-based business. Okay, this is probably a slide that a lot of people in the room want me to go into a lot more detail than I have, and I'm just going to give you the basics here. Is how does a BAM operate under a 501c3 structure? Because it's sort of like, I don't get it. I'm setting up a business. Am I allowed to be a nonprofit? And the short answer is yes, under some conditions. The first is that BAM, in order for you to maintain that tax exemption, has to be in line with the charitable or religious purpose for which you applied and got the tax exemption. And that also means that there can't be an inurement or benefit to any private individual, such as a family member of the nonprofit or shareholder or anybody else. Now, if you're a business connected to an existing 501c3, then you have to have an agreement in place that states clearly that that the business is advancing the charitable purpose. The simplest example is some countries in the world, they don't have well-established nonprofit law. And so what that means is for you to operate at all, China is an example of this, for you to operate at all, by and large, you're operating as a business, even though what you're actually doing day-to-day is just ministry and nonprofit activity.
And so you actually have to pay taxes on that. And so you have to, you know, set up accounting, and your revenue stream is most of your donor dollars, et cetera. And so that's the easiest example of how business can operate within a 501c3. So the only way that I can do my religious charter in China is by being a business, and IRS generally doesn't scrutinize that. But it also means that 501c3 has to have control for that to work. Now, some people may actually try to register their business right off the bat as a 501c3 themselves, and that is possible, but I think tough. So I wouldn't encourage that, but again, you may want to consult a lawyer for more detail on that. And then the final sort of out here is, or option, is you can have an unrelated business in your nonprofit. If the business is unrelated to the core activity of your charter, then you just pay tax for that business. It's no big deal. So that's those are some options if you are a nonprofit trying to be banned. Now, obviously, there are a whole host of financing structures that we can talk about, and you know, it's a simple framework for complexity and expectation of financial return. I won't go into this in great detail, but I think people kind of get the general point here. Let me share with you two hybrid examples and then close. There was a foundation that was approached with a landscaping business proposal. And the landscaping business would employ developmentally delayed adults. And they were asking for a $500,000 capital investment, or a startup investment. Now, the foundation could have just said, okay, $500,000 grant, done, right, and you off and run. But they decided instead to do something a little different. And what foundations like ours have at our disposal, but we have not ever used, just to be real candid here. But I want some of you guys to push us in the philanthropy world to consider using it more, which is what's called a program-related investment. Now, a program-related investment is a way by which we can invest our corpus dollars, and it has to basically be it has to be an investment that is accepting, the foundation is accepting higher risk and lower return. So, to put it one way, it would be an investment that you probably wouldn't make if it wasn't something in line with your foundation's purpose, right? But it is an investment vehicle. And so what this foundation chose to do was they made a blended investment, $200,000 in grant money and $300,000 in PRI loan. And so there's a hybrid example of things that some people who are interested in philanthropy, but also you're doing a business and you want to be sustainable, consider. Another example is a much smaller example. A website called Kiva.org is trying to get people to give money to entrepreneurs in developing countries who often are coming out of microenterprise situations and are, in some of these cases, needing that next level of investment. And so Kiva is basically sort of an aggregator of these projects or people and introducing them to potential investors. And this is not tax deductible because what you're giving them is a no interest loan. So basically you're saying, I'm willing to subsidize your loan, but it's a loan. You got to pay it back. So a couple hybrid examples. And here's my email if you would like to ask for the presentation. I went a lot longer than I expected. I'm sorry. But I do want to leave. How much time do we have?
8:45. We have 20 more minutes.
Okay, 20 minutes. 20 minutes. Let's have a robust, hearty, good discussion here. I would love to hear from a couple people in the room their story. And if you have a specific question or issue or how you are handling the funding and financing question to share with the rest of the group, it would be extremely helpful. So who wants to be brave enough to be the first volunteer? Just share with us a little bit about the venture concept we evolved. Yes, please.
Wow. Creating a medical record system for the development as people medical treatment that have their usually no records on the street. It's not good for people who are not really doing it. So that's the concept. My background is technology, which I'm saying to explain some of my business activities. But also my technology. The business plan is we provide the infrastructure for gathering this data. We also provide online consultation with national physicians. The way we make money, we charge for operating costs from the use of participating. But the data, the aggregated, anonymized data, is very valuable to pharmaceutical development research.
Okay.
That's the idea. I'm right at the point where I'm needing funding. And I've really been wrestling with the whole concept. I had no idea that band was known, and I thought it was doing this. The only person in the world wrestling with all these types of issues. I'm really very confused.
Well, give us a flavor for some of the places that you're going to
provide your service.
Well, I'm doing the prototype in Guatemala. We're going to make sure that it works. But part of the whole goal is to make it it'll work almost anywhere. It's just that I may not have a national network of physicians. If somebody wanted to take it to Africa, that's fine. But I wouldn't have that.
And how have you approached, at least initially, the whole funding question? Where have you where did you imagine you would go to get money for this?
I assume different investment groups is the number one. I've been developing for 2 years and have considerable amount of investment in the society.
And you didn't submit a business plan?
No, I didn't even know about
that. Okay.
I just learned about this 2 weeks ago.
Because that would be a great, I think that would be a great candidate for a business plan.
I think it's an absolutely brilliant idea to do this. I say that believing firmly that the Lord didn't think that.
So there's an example of sort of your more commercially oriented business, but obviously somebody who has a hard desire to make kingdom oriented, and so you can go after your more traditional investors.
And my quandary all along, what I've been thinking about going to investors is if you even typically can't, that's the humanitarian side. They're like, well, you know, we're really doing this, you know, not for business, and therefore they're not as focused on the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm afraid to suggest that my motives are really to help people, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you know, I don't think I'm being truthful with that. I saw this whole thing coming. There's this big pipe. I've been leaping through laws, and international laws, and technical and medical issues. But this one, I just didn't know how I was going to deal with it. And so I went to this conference, but I still don't know how to deal with it. I'm sure you can answer that.
Well, I mean, there's no simple answer other than that. What I would say is if it's a sound business plan, it's a sound business plan. And people can evaluate that on its own merits. If you, and I don't know if the investors are going to be largely Christian or not, and that may influence how you message this a little bit, but, you know, let them evaluate it based on the business. But if you've got a solid business and then you tell them, hey, here's my heart and the motivation behind it, I mean, all the more compelling to me, you know, as an investor. But it's an interesting question. What I would caution anybody against, and I don't suspect this at all from you, is sometimes people get into severe mixed messaging that can be very confusing. I'll give you an example. I got a call from a guy, a retired lawyer in Southern California, who I will go unnamed, who wanted to pitch our chairman an idea. And so I have the privilege sometimes of being a gatekeeper on these things, because they're always black. And in this particular idea, he said, I've got a film, Christian movie, that I'm going to make, and it's going to reach 1 billion people.
So, you know, you're like, okay, so tell me more about it. Give me the bottom line, or, you know, what's the concept, what's, you know, sort of the essence of the story. And the very first thing he did to me, the very first thing was, he sort of gave me this whole, you know, testimony, a little, very long-winded testimony, how he got to this point, got the idea for the movie from the dream. And then, so the punchline was, so you got to sign this non-disclosure agreement with a non-compete clause for me to even tell you anything about the movie. And I just sort of looked back and I just said, hey, you know, reality check here, buddy. Right? I mean, what do you really think anybody, you know, is going to buy this if like, you're so paranoid about, like, the uniqueness of this, like, movie concept that you can't even, like, give me the pitch without me signing some legal document that, you know, by the way, was so open-ended and vague in language that could have actually, you know, potentially, if you wanted to really play the lawyer on this, harmed our principal in pursuing other ventures, even ministry ventures, for example. So I was just like, you know, forget it. Those billion people, I'm sure, you know, you can find a way to reach them if God wants you to have this movie, but we're not going to be one of your investors. So, you know, there's this sense of mixed messaging that, you know, they try to heap guilt on me that it's almost like my Christian duty to get behind this movie, and yet he's not willing to, you know, do anything that might compromise commercial prospects. So, right.
You asked
about
open source. Maybe just talk about the titles. First off, it's very difficult to understand. And what it is, it's a translation. It's clearer and deeper
write a couple of these ideas, one of which is the whole concept of indigenization. It's a growing trend. It's a sea change in the way missions is being done, right? I mean, both from in terms of leadership on the ground, if you're involved in a band, having local people who are integrally involved in managing and hopefully owning the business. But as Dwight mentioned, don't underestimate that they can fund. Center for Community Transformation, the example I gave about the MEP program. Its board of directors, 100% Filipino, all wealthy, all believers, all totally committed to the ministry, and huge contributors to what they're doing. So it's a great point. But it's also a point that there aren't probably as many countries as we'd like to think that have a great potential for indigenous Christian donors. So, Steve.
One thing I've noticed, getting back to your comment, you said it's either a solid business plan or it's not. And very often Christians, when they pitch these ideas, because there's a humanitarian dimension, because they're doing God's work, they're going to expect that you'll accept a 6% return or something like that. And frankly, that doesn't fly in the business world. And so there's got to be a sea change in terms of just the way the aspiring BAMers are thinking about their business. And it's not immoral at all to expect a 50 or 100% return. When you start doing the math and you look at your portfolio, recognizing that half of them are going to fail, you need at least some of them to double or triple or go through the roof. And so, there's a long way to go. A lot of people are expecting 6%, and then they wonder why they can't get anyone to loan them or invest in their business.
Great point. Anybody else have a question or should I share a story?
Yeah, I had a question on just on market-based returns. My friend and I went to business school in Michigan, and then we pulled together a lot of resources in Michigan. A friend and family, I have a finance background, an operations background. I mean, one of the questions that we were wrestling with is, in a market-efficient model, when you're raising money from investors and you're paying a certain expectation for them, what happens if the investment that you make starts to have other ministry things that take off, and say for example your exit strategy doesn't come to fruition? How do you deal with like the relationship with the investor when there's clearly a ministry opportunity that exists or may develop over time, say with certain BAM, and that might not necessarily be in line with what the original investor had thought of? How do you kind of manage that relationship and have that investor exit in a reasonable way?
It's a great question. Dwight, maybe you might have it. Did you hear the question?
Yeah. Communicate.
Yeah.
Well, in general, it's pretty tough. If you have more than three investors, you get them with the information. It's very, very difficult. So, I'm not giving them all. I'm not deciding on what to do. These aren't investors that are particularly about the information. So, some businesses that they have high.
Yeah, I mean, what I was going to say is it's all about the expectations that you set and the nature of your relationship with the people that invested. I mean, if they from the get-go sort of bought into the idea that there was some nimbleness that they were going to allow for, that if it had to do with a ministry opportunity, then, obviously you'd be okay. But if they went into it with the mentality of in the way you pitched it was as a market-based return on investment, and then you said, well, something has changed and we really want to change course, you could strain some of those relationships and caution.
Yes?
Could you talk a little bit about if you have a business plan any kind of a public, organized BAM network? In our church, I'm a business pastor, and a lot of our people in our church have MBA, different backgrounds. We're in Silicon Valley, and the business plan, I mean, there are schools in that from great business schools, and yet what I'd like to see is the, there's people that we know that have the finance and the social return, but the spiritual return, having not so much the donor dollars, but the wisdom, advice, influence, and expertise coming to the process. Where is there something that out there where we can tap into, or is it just kind of a relational network, for people to speak into that process? And help that process birth into a successful BAM versus just a secular business that does good social things?
Well, first thing I'd say is you're at the right place. you're going to connect with a lot of those networks, and they do exist. But let me open it up. Does anybody want to offer? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a businesssolution.com. It's a YMAP site. It's
helpful.
It's very best.
Yeah, there are two or three kind of well-known networks. I think EC Institute is another one. Steve, you probably...
Yeah, they pulled the plug out of CI.
Oh, they have, okay. Are there others that you would recommend?
No, it's not developing as quickly as I'd like to see that. There's a BAM blog now, too. Does anyone know Justin, what's his name? Yeah, Justin Foreman. Would you know that this URL to that or
Blogspot?
Blogspot, yeah. You might find it at the YWAM. It's still here.
It's with right. So, yeah, he's with rightnow.org. But that's,
yeah.
I don't know. That's
well,
yeah. Yeah, that's more of a student.
Okay, I'll just Google and meet the people.
I mean, let me really encourage you to just network here, because there are a number of smaller scale networks, people who are doing things, and a lot of times they have more regional focus. Like I can think of a couple. I don't know the names off the top of my head that are doing Eastern Europe. A couple that are focusing on Southeast Asia. So. You know, it sort of depends on where you guys are headed with your church and who you have and what type of ministry involvement you want to have specifically.
Yes, that's a good question. As a funder, how do you weigh the social returns, not the social, the spiritual returns and the financial returns of a company when you're looking at investments? Do you lean more towards the one or the other?
That's an interesting question. Did everyone hear that? So he said, when you're looking at it as an investor, how do you weigh financial return and social return? Is there a way to weight one versus the other? So what I did at the IFC for 6 months was I developed a modified adjusted present value tool that was supposed to try to help integrate both social return on investment and financial return on investment. It's a complicated question. I mean, it really depends. It depends. I mean, you know, with any kind of modeling, it's all your assumptions and your inputs, right? So, it really speaks to A, how you're going to measure spiritual return, and then what its relative weighting is going to be for you, because it's ultimately going to be some type of composite index for you to be able to suggest. And you know, what I would really also say is sometimes when it comes to ministry stuff, there are two extremes that I want people to try to avoid, and this is coming from a foundation perspective. One extreme is, and you see this a lot with business people who try to do investing into ministry, is they try to metricize everything. And there's just some things in life that you can't metricize. So you just have to sort of accept qualitative measures. The other side of the extreme, though, I think is just as, not pernicious is probably too strong of a word, but I'd also equally discourage, which is sort of abdicating responsibility for measuring anything. A lot of people sort of say, you know, well, God's doing the work and it's going to reach thousands of people. And I get frustrated with those kind of answers, because I think that although so much of what we do is immeasurable and of eternal value that we can't see, there's also a lot that we can do to apply good stewardship, to know that we have applied good stewardship of our time and resources and energy. And so to the extent that you apply some discipline to that, I think the better off you are. We probably have time for maybe one last question or story. Yes, sir.
How do you work with people in a micro-enterprise environment that is used to the cash business? They have $5 they spend four to five new things, they live on the $1 a day. To take them from there into a sustainable business where it's easy to register and pay taxes, and you know, getting out of that in, not just the environment, but the mental frame of mind of, you know, I need to grow this into something more sustainable that can be And from a not necessarily from a funding perspective, but from an operational perspective, taking that business model. Because I've got a couple of friends who've invested, and they find it very hard to get that mindset of the people who've now got this business out of just the day-to-day operation, although the potential is enormous.
Ken Eldred talks about, in his research, and I think it comes from Opportunity International, about 10 to 15% of MEDs are entrepreneurial people who want to break out to the next threshold. So there's a minority of people that are, of the disposition of the sort of the makeup to want to go bigger and want to do things. It's sort of just natural. But in all cases, when you're dealing with an environment where it's microeconomy based, they had to go through a lifetime of lacking infrastructure. A lot of times, education level is fairly low. There's a lot of training and a lot of mentoring that needs to take place to help get people to just get financial basics, so business basics. And so what a lot of people are doing is, the business incubator example is one story, they are providing that training as part of their ministry. So that's what a lot of people in the ministry side is called the value add. It's sort of not the reason why you'll never be financially self-sustainable in some people's mind is because they're trying to provide services that a lot of secular MEDs aren't doing, which is dealing with a group of people that just need to kind of have a little bit more hand-holding in business process. And so I think there's going to be a period of time in certain areas of the world where you're always going to be relying probably on some level of in-kind donation of business people from the West or other parts of the region helping to provide that training at a cost either to themselves pro bono or through donor dollars. Well, I think that's it for our time, right? I really encourage people to try to go to the business plan competition. I'm going to walk over there. It sounds really interesting. But obviously there are other great seminars that will take place right after this.
Oh, thank you very much.